The information in the following podcast is provided for general informational purposes only and may not reflect the current law in any particular jurisdiction. This information should not be construed as legal advice and is not intended to substitute for legal counsel on any subject matter. Listening to this podcast does not create any attorney-client relationship. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Not So Intellectual Property, IP for the People, a look at current events and news through the lens of intellectual property law by two fairly normal guys. I'm Nick Jingo, an IP attorney focusing on brand protection. With me, as always, is my co-host Kyle Fleming, whose practice focuses on IP dispute resolution. All right, welcome to another episode of Not So Intellectual Property podcast. Got Kyle here as usual.
Hey.
Say hello to the fans.
Yeah, from Sunny Bay Village, Ohio.
That's right. It's very rainy here. Getting away from college sports for once and jumping to something else that's kind of ubiquitous these days. Kyle and I are going to talk today about COVID vaccines and IP. And in particular, kind of a unique wrinkle that we came up with, actually, or stumbled upon, I guess I would say. I'm not going to give myself that much credit. the gist of it is that there is a kind of seldom used piece of legislation that kind of provides a safe harbor for government contractors in patent infringement lawsuits. And there's a situation kind of ongoing right now in Delaware where a big drug manufacturer, Moderna, is putting forth kind of this defense of, well, we were making this COVID vaccine because the government asked us to. And so even though maybe it infringes somebody else's patent, there's no infringement. So that's kind of the nutshell. I know, Kyle, I know you had a little more background on the case and, you know, can you fill us in a little?
Yeah. So couple plaintiffs who claim that, you know, they have a patent on some aspect of the COVID vaccine, right, sued Moderna for patent infringement in the District of Delaware. I mean, so far, that's pretty standard. That's the way that happens every day, right? Something like that. In this case, though, Moderna moved to dismiss because it says that the correct party to sue is actually the U.S. government. And there's a special provision of the U.S. Code, 28 U.S.C. 1498, which is essentially a form of waiver of sovereign immunity. But what it says is that the government has the right to essentially procure any product or service regardless of patent protection. And the sole recourse of the patent owner is to sue the government. You have to do it in the Court of Federal Claims. And you're entitled to some compensation. I think a reasonable royalty and maybe attorney's fees in some cases. But you're not entitled to an injunction and you're not entitled to any recovery against the supplier or the contractor or whomever provided these goods or services to the government. This law has been around quite a while and actually has its roots back in kind of, you know, the war effort. I'm not sure which war, probably World War I, but, you know, where the government was afraid it wasn't going to be able to get what it needed.
Yeah, so, right. I think it was, I mean, I'm trying to remember some of the other applications that I saw of this,
right,
of the statute. It was, I know there was more recently, it was things like carbon fiber sheets for aircraft. I think there was a big kerfuffle around night vision goggles, right? Night vision goggles. So it's typically been in wartime, right? When we need, the government needs a bunch of manufacturers to pump out some product that's going to help the war effort. I mean, as you could tell by the tech there, I think those were things that were a little more recent, but
right.
You know, how can we encourage manufacturers to go do this when on the other hand, they know that maybe a competitor has a patent? Well, let's give them some
right
kind of defense and shield where the government can step in and say, look, we'll take the blame here, but understand that the best you're going to get out of this is, like you said, is maybe a reasonable royalty or some limited damages.
Yeah. And I think the Court of Federal Claims usually set, I think the royalty is like 5 or 8% or something. It's not, it's not like a huge amount. And it's also, it, from reading some cases, it also doesn't seem to get like seriously fought over that often. I think there's kind of like a fixed.
Yeah. I got the impression it almost felt like a, what do they call it? Like the compulsory licenses, like for
right, exactly.
music or, right. I forget what the terminology is, but yeah, it was almost like a fixed, it's not even like a damages case, like where you have got experts arguing about what a reasonable royalty right. is so much as it's like a, yeah, it's always this much. That's what we do.
Right. It's like a rand or a frand royalty, right? Fair and reasonable.
That's what
right?
it is. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So it's pretty interesting. Yeah. And I guess, you know, as we were just saying, it makes sense when the government is in need of something, it wants to be able to get it. And it doesn't want suppliers declining or saying that they can't do it because someone else has a patent on it. Or if you're the government and you already, you know, if you're the army or something and you have, I don't know, I'm trying to imagine, like, you know, you have jet fighters and you need some kind of critical component to go on it. You can't be at the mercy of one supplier, you know, to supply it, either because they can't supply enough or for some other reason, you know. So I think that's pretty interesting. It's, you know, and I guess too, I guess this also probably comes up a lot behind the scenes in when the government is in the process of trying to procure something and is being kind of held up, so to speak, by the patent owner.
Yeah, like as a threat almost, right? Like, look, patent owner, you know, you can work with us here. You can license this out the way you want to license it out, right?
Yep.
But at the end of the day, understand that if you don't do this, we're going to do this. And, you know, one piece that I thought was really interesting here is just like the speed with which this can happen. Like it's not like a process. There's not like an application process or a fair warning or anything like that. It's like the government can basically just instantaneously be like, yep, 1498. We're going to go, you know, you go do that thing. We're good. Don't worry about it. We'll handle it. And if it comes up, 1498 is going to cover it. Like right. There's no warning.
Yeah.
Which makes sense, right? I mean, again, historically, this is war effort. This is decisions need to be made quickly for the, you know, quote unquote, the greater public good.
Right.
And I think what's interesting to me is, and again, I think, I know I read about, like, I think it was hepatitis C maybe, fairly recently. So I guess what I was getting at is, so, you know, historically this looks like a war effort thing, but it has been used in public health context, at least as a threat or as a proposed option. I know that it came up in relation to hepatitis, where it was kind of like, hepatitis C, that's what it was, where you had like senators, it was Bernie Sanders actually, amongst others, calling on the federal government to use 1498 because the price of hepatitis C drugs was so high that it was prohibitive to the point where like we had an ongoing public health crisis because people just couldn't afford the drugs. Ultimately, I don't think they used 1498. I think that was an example, I think, of what you just brought up, Kyle, which is the government basically saying, look, you need to do this or else.
Right. I've heard it. I think I've read recently some calls by people to use it in connection with like EpiPens and what else? I mean, maybe some kind of insulin, where some people think that the price is just way out of proportion to what it should be,
yeah.
or what it needs to be.
As a patent practitioner though, right? Or as a Putting on my patent owner hat, I guess. Not that I'm a patent owner. I mean, it is scary to some degree, though, right? Because, like, the war effort thing is one thing, and I think probably COVID is one thing, right? I mean, this is a global pandemic. It's kind of like a everybody together or everyone falls, right?
Right.
But you start to get into like the drug market, and it's now you're are you using a hammer when you should be using a scalpel, right? Like, by kind of going around and saying, these drugs are too expensive, 1498. These drugs are too expensive, 1498. Well, aren't you kind of undercutting, undercutting capitalism, right? Supply and demand. You put in the effort to develop the drug. You got a patent, which gives you the exclusive right to make, use, and sell the drug, which is the whole point of the patent system. Now, all of a sudden, I guess it's to some degree, it's creating a cap on, yes, that's all true, but you also can't be a jerk about it, basically, right? Like, you can't go and charge an arm and a leg for the stuff just because we gave you the monopoly. It's like, it's another limit on the limited monopoly, I suppose.
Right. And I guess in practice, you still have the patent owner still has a competitive advantage over other providers or potential providers, because the government would have to pay whatever that other company is charging, right? Plus 10%, right? On top of it, you know, as the royalty. So
that's a good point.
So it's not a total, it's not totally leveling the playing field, but it is definitely putting some downward pressure on the patent owners, rights. I think it's also interesting too, because I think in a typical drug case, the government isn't buying all the output for everyone, right? The government is buying, I guess, for Medicaid or Medicare or I don't know, one of those programs. But there's this whole private market where people are buying, you know, the drug as well. CVS and, you know, I mean, all pharmacies and whatever else to sell it. The COVID thing is interesting, because I guess the federal government was the one buying all of them. So like when you go to Costco or CVS or your, you know, immunization place of choice, I'm guessing that the federal government ultimately bought those things and is redistributing them, which is how you get into this 1498, as opposed to Costco going to Moderna and buying it directly. Because then this wouldn't apply.
Right.
You'd have to sue Costco or something.
Yeah. Right. Which again feels more like a war effort thing, right? It's like rationing.
Right.
We need all the aluminum in the country, not just some of it, all of it, right? And we need every sheet of carbon fiber or, you know, all the night vision gear. Like it's
right.
It's a different level. Again, it almost feels like maybe, you know, is this section really like the nuclear option, right? Like to some degree, I think maybe it is, right? Because it is, although I guess that is maybe overstating it. Like you said, it's the patent owner still being compensated. It's not as though this doesn't feel like, what is it? Well, I guess, I mean, you know, where the government takes your house to build a highway, right? They don't just take your house. You are compensated for it, but maybe you're not compensated to the degree that you could have been, or maybe you're, you know, you didn't want to sell it, period. Right. It's a forced license, but licensed nonetheless.
Right. Right. So I guess this is, should have looked at this before today. So I guess the judge though denied the motion to dismiss just recently and essentially said 1498 didn't apply because the development and sale of the vaccines was for the benefit of the vaccine's recipients, not the government, based on the complaint alone. So
maybe you amend the complaint. I mean, isn't the government the citizens?
Yeah, right, right.
You know?
What essentially the court said was that whether this is a 1498 case or not can't be decided on a 12B6 motion.
Okay, so it wasn't a...
It wasn't a definitive, It was a punt, right? Yeah, exactly. And again,
which makes sense.
Right, which does make sense.
Right, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. And there's some pretty high reaching results. I mean,
right.
If it isn't a 1498 case, it's a standard patent infringement case, and you've got damages probably in the millions, right?
Right.
I mean,
right. And I don't know. So, I don't know if the government stepped in to this at all and took a position.
Yeah. And I think that's another piece of it. Cause I think there was a line of cases that I found that talked about, on the one hand, cases where the government explicitly orders something, right?
Right.
And that's kind of an easy situation where the government is like explicitly saying, "Hey, don't worry, we'll cover you under 1498." But there was other line of cases where it was like essentially implied that because the government was asking for something in a certain way, it kind of came under 1498, and it would seem like maybe this is more that way, right? It's the government encouraging manufacturers to move on vaccines.
Right. right? So here, I guess what happened here is that the government actually didn't file anything in the case. And the contract that was submitted, I guess, by defendants was heavily redacted.
Yeah.
No surprise. And so the court said, I can't tell whether the government authorized and consented to the, for lack of a better word, the infringement, right?
Right. Because, and it, that goes back to kind of what you said at the very beginning, which is it's, at some level, it's a waiver of sovereign immunity. And I guess you don't want to go around waiving the government's sovereign immunity on its own behalf.
Right.
Willy-nilly.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting.
You want to be pretty
sure.
Yeah,
it's definitely an interesting case. I mean, I think for people that practice in the government contracting business, this probably isn't that interesting in a way, or isn't that unusual. But I think for everyone else, it's
like you
it's
said,
pretty unusual.
Yeah. To me, it's probably a behind the scenes thing more often than you'd think. On the other hand, from like a from an IP practitioner's perspective, it's interesting just because if I represent a patent owner now, it's like, oh, by the way, there is this sword of Damocles kind of hanging over.
Right.
It's again, it's a big one. Like, you know, if you're a mom and pop ice cream shop, it's not really anything to worry about. But if you're playing in kind of higher level tech, you could see
right.
It. And I mean, you could even see it, I guess, you know, in lower level tech if depending on the situation. But it is out there. I think to me the kind of the cool piece and why we're talking about it on this podcast is I think we all have experience with COVID vaccines, love them or hate them, or where
right.
we stand on it. You know, they're out there, and there's lots of marketing about them. And you know, I think, regardless of how you feel about the vaccines, the fact that we as a country were able to roll out all these vaccines so quickly was pretty mind boggling.
Right.
And I think, to some degree, maybe this is why, right?
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't just like this altruistic, all for one, one for all. Let's all work a lot really hard to get these things out. I think it maybe also was the government saying, like, you know, get cranking on this and don't be too worried about IP. Right. And
right.
Now, was that enough to shield people from 1498? I think that's part of what the court's going to look at here, but it at least suggested that was part of it.
Right.
And that's kind of, to me, that's just the interest. That's the interesting wrinkle from your common man, right? IP for the people, like, you've got these vaccines floating around out in the world right now, and that this is at least in part why they're out there.
Right. And in this particular case, I don't know anything about, I didn't look up the patents to see, you know.
Yeah, right. I don't know.
Do these actually apply to the vaccine itself? Did it apply to the way the vaccines were made or the way the vaccines
right.
were developed?
Yeah,
you know, or
right.
anything like that.
I was simplifying.
Right, right,
sure.
right, right. Yeah,
yeah
right.
It's
right. So it is kind of interesting, but definitely interesting. And we'll see how this case plays out. I mean, you're right. The court pretty much just kicked the can down the road, which leads to me to believe that this isn't the last we've heard about it.
Right, I agree. I think this one will be ripe for a follow up, and we'll be there for it. I think that about wraps it up. Thanks again for listening. And we'll be back with something more here in the near future.
All right, thanks.
Well, folks, that does it for today's episode of Not So Intellectual Property. Before we sign off, we'd like to thank our firm, Renner Auto, for sponsoring the podcast. Renner Auto is a boutique IP firm located in Cleveland, Ohio. Our IP attorneys help identify, protect, manage, enforce, and defend intellectual property assets domestically and abroad, for a diverse group of clients, including multinational corporations, mid-sized companies, startups, and universities. For more information about Renner Auto, please visit www.rennerauto.com. If you have any questions for Kyle or me, you can email us at nsip@rennerauto.com, or you can find our individual contact info at the firm website. If you like what you heard, give us a review. Make sure to subscribe so you receive future episodes as they come out. Thanks for listening.